there for all sorts of reasons. Some was romance, some was escaping having to take the transports to Germany to work. Some was the idea that this was a place of clean living, the high, pure mountain air, not the exigencies and compromises you had to make with the Germans. There was a whole mixture of motives.
That was Paddy Ashdown talking about the factors that led French people to join up with the country's resistance movement in the Second World War.
Talk about the concrete, and people might think, well, that doesn't sound terribly enticing, but it's done with great panache here, I think. Yeah. I think Sidney Little was a very clever man.
And that was Catherine Ferry discussing the history of a British seaside town. Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast. My name is Rob Attar, and I'm the editor of BBC History Magazine, which is Britain's best-selling history magazine. You can find us in all good newsagents or take out a subscription from anywhere in the world. Head to historyextra.com/subscribe for our latest subscription offers. And you can also get hold of digital editions of the magazine for the iPad, the Kindle Fire, Google Play and Zinio. If you want details of those, head to historyextra.com/digital. D-Day is one of the most famous events of the Second World War. Yet the actions of members of the French Resistance in the months and years beforehand are less well known outside of France. In his new book, The Cruel Victory, former Liberal Democrat leader Paddy Ashdown explores their story, focusing particularly on the Maquis de Vecours, a rural group of French resistance fighters who converged on the Vecours Plateau in southeast France. Our book's editor, Matt Elton, met up with Paddy in his Somerset home to find out more. I'm afraid there may be a bit of background noise in the early parts of this interview, but I do hope you'll persevere because it is a fascinating discussion.
Why do you think people signed up for the resistance?
I think there is a lot of misunderstanding about this. I mean, I think there were some genuine resistors. They were all genuine resistors at the end and gave their lives for it. Mm. The people who started this were... The extraordinary thing is that the idea of the Vercors as a centre of resistance, a place of refuge in which the shattered elements of broken France could find retreat. And that was quite old. I mean, you know, it's not, I think, insignificant that when the Alsaciens were driven out of Alsace-Lorraine, when the Poles were driven out of Paris, they went to the Vercors.
Yeah.
But quite suddenly, at the same time in 1941, three groups of people, absolutely different. Mm. One intellectual France, two great writers, arguably France's greatest young writer of the day, and another great writer, together with a few miles away, but separately and unknown to them, the defeated army after the army of the armistice was disbanded, and then a group of socialists in a working class cafe in Grenoble all had at pretty well the same time the same idea. Let's create a place which we could, when the hour of liberation comes, we could hold as a fortress for the Allies to fly in.
Yeah.
So I think their views were all about liberation. They were the role that the Vercors would play in liberation. But I think it's really important to understand that without the young men, this would never have happened. It would just have been a sort of middle-aged man's dream. The young men who were suddenly conscripted into the Service Travail Obligatoire, the STO, the compulsory work in Germany, by Sauckel and Laval... went there as a place not to have to go to Germany and found themselves therefore. I mean, they were there for all sorts of reasons. Some was romance, some was escaping having to take the transports to Germany to work. Some was the idea that this was a place of clean living, the high, pure mountain air, not the exigencies and compromises you had to make with the Germans. There was a whole mixture of motives. But what I think is fascinating, and that's why I spent quite a lot of time in the build-up, is to see that these three, four disparate elements all came together. Mm. Uncomfortably sometimes, the young men became hardened, muscular, Maquisards, walking over the mountains, committed to the cause. The others came together, set aside their political differences, or largely did, in order to take on the Germans. So it was the way that different motives were coagulated into a single aim.
Yes.
By the act of German oppression and occupation.
Mm. Was there a single act of that occupation and repression that you feel helped make the resistance a genuinely popular one?
STO, Service Terroriste, Travail Obligatoire. The German ambassador in Paris says, and I quote him in the book, you know, when the memorials are put up to the French resistance, one should go to Sauckel, the German Minister of Labour, because it was his insistence on youth being sent to Germany which drove the young men up onto the mountains.
And you talked about the idealistic impression of what life was like there. Do we get a sense of what actual the reality of daily life was like in these camps, and then when the camps had to disband, I suppose?
Yeah, well, the camps never did disband except when the Germans came.
Yes.
And then they were forced to, of course. Yeah, I mean, I think particularly the winter of 1941-42, which was a very, very hard winter, suddenly the romance of, you know, going up to the place you'd had summer holidays for the summer sounded fun. Mm. Helping in the harvests, you know, the pretty girls about, that was also fun. But the bitter, bitter cold and misery of the 41-42 winter, which was a very, very hard winter, in which they were holed up in small mountain refuges, I think that must have been very, very hard. And about half of the young men who went up there for refuge returned to the valley because they simply couldn't put up with it. Everything that they got, every drop of water, every log of wood they had to go out and cut for themselves, must have been very tough for them.
Yes, yes. And you have touched on this, the sense of there being some divide between the military...
Oh, not some divide, a very, very big divide.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It was this in the end that... I mean, inevitably in those things, personalities count. The particular personality of the patron, Eugène Chalon, and Alain Luret, the early military commander, they got on very well together. But then there was, and it was much more typical of the French military, Narcisse. I often think that it's a very appropriate Narcissus.
Yes.
Gé. Pompous, arrogant, small of stature, a cavalryman, believed in... he went to war under the royalist standard, although, of course, France was a republic, but right-wing conservative, and the primary civil organisations, which were socialist, Masonic being left-wing in France, there was a very sharp divide. And it was the divide which I think also is reflected in the French Constitution. Who commands the military? And in France, there's always been some opaqueness about that. Is the military under civil command or not? And you think of de Gaulle, you think of Napoleon. Whereas the new France, and here's the big thing that comes out of the book, in my view. Actually, what they were fighting for were two things. One is, how do we get rid of the Germans? But two is, what is the nature of the new France that emerges after the shame? The army wanted to keep France as it was. Hierarchical, Catholic, essentially right-wing, quite wooden and la gloire. The socialists who ran the civil operation wanted to have a new France, much more in tune with the tenets of the revolution. And that was a very severe, a very severe dividing line. It didn't wreck them. In the end, it worked out. But it certainly created huge internal tensions.
Mm. And talking of tensions, do we get a sense of the tensions between the French and the British in terms of the run-up to D-Day?
Actually, only small glimpses, I have to say, in this. The two fascinating characters in this, on the British point of view, one is the fabulous, glorious, fabulously beautiful, fabulously courageous, fabulously promiscuous Christine Granville, Christine Escarbeck, the Countess Skarbek, Polish Countess, who was dropped in to be the courier and indeed makes love with the greatest SOE agent, Francis Kamerz. By the way, my next book will be on him.
Oh, cool.
Fabulous man.
Yeah.
On the very first day she arrives, on the very first day they meet, I mean, they didn't hang about.
Yes.
They were at the time being shelled by the Germans and bombed. I suppose that pushes things along a bit. And through Francis Kamerz's messages home, you suddenly begin to understand that he talks about a growing mood of Anglophobia because of the failure of D-Day to be delivered in 42. Everybody thought D-Day was coming in 1943, and the delay caused a lot of problems. But what is interesting to me is that there is no hint of it anywhere from anywhere else. And the two SOE people dropped in, bizarrely, Long and Hausmann, I think they were wholly unsuitable. One of them couldn't even speak French. and who left under some cloud of suspicion. When an inquiry was held into them, the French went out of their way never to badmouth them. So if there was an underlying tension, it's subliminal and not seen in the book, in my view. What I think is amazing, though, is that, you know, here's this little country, we think it's a little country, and suddenly the whole of France is depending on us for liberation.
Yeah.
It's British Halifax bombers that suddenly appear overhead to drop them the arms. You know, you get the sense of the last great flowering of a genuinely world power, and this is the last moment for it, I suppose.
Wow. I mean, in terms of that aid, how much did Churchill's decisions to drop these kind of packages influence the course of the events?
Well, I think it did. I mean, I think it made people's dreams a reality. I don't say that it added to the cause of the resistance. It may have done, because people suddenly realised that Britain really was backing him. But Churchill, you know, he was said to be, the famous word, he was said to be starry-eyed about spies and SOE operations and the underground. He was also very canny politically. He wanted, the whole argument was centred, and why the Vercors is so important, is do we attack, this is the second attack on France after D-Day from the south, or is it Churchill's plan, what he called the soft underbelly? Mm. And that would have been across the Italian passes and into France. Far better way of doing it, by the way. And Churchill suddenly realised that all the aid he'd been putting into the Balkans, because he originally wanted to go up to Bulgaria through the Balkans, was going to be irrelevant, because France was going to be the next field of battle.
Right.
And he shifts the whole huge cornucopia of arms going into Tito and dumps it into the Alps, and primarily into the Vercors. In that sense, it made the dreams a reality, and it gave people a sense that, you know, this was definitely going to happen.
OK, talking about the months up until May 1944, I suppose, what do you think was the biggest strategic failing?
Muddle. Mm. I mean, I don't suppose we can, you know, you need to put yourself in the historical context before you stand back and condemn, but there was a fantastic degree of muddle in unclear lines of communication, unclear thinking. I think it's because the whole French resistance operation had been going for 2 years. It had a momentum of its own, and it was the only thing that mattered. It was the only way of hitting back. And suddenly we're about to do D-Day. And D-Day is the mega operation upon which everything depends. It's an entirely military operation. There was a resistance side to it, but a pretty well entirely military operation. So all the effort goes into D-Day, and there's this sort of orphan sculling around saying, what do we do with these people? The answer was, they came up with a very good plan. So I don't think it was tied in properly. So let's just go through the mistakes. One was muddle. Let's take a look at Eisenhower. On the famous 2 days before D-Day, Eisenhower says, tout le monde à la bataille, the famous words of Foch. The original plan was to get the resistance in the north of France to rise, but keep the resistance in the south of France, in places like the Vercors, undercover, to be used in the course of the southern landing. When one of the agents dropped into the Vercors came back and said, if you do that, the Germans will know you're only going to land in the north. The Germans were convinced there was going to be a pretty well simultaneous landing in the south, and originally that was what was planned. And so Eisenhower took this decision, which cost thousands of French lives, no question about it, to make the whole of the resistance and the whole of France rise when it was vastly premature for those in the south. On the other hand, in my view, that was an entirely right military decision, tough but right. D-Day was very close around that. I think sometimes we understand how close. And I think that if I had been Eisenhower, I would have made that decision. Churchill, I think, is constantly trying to undermine the southern landing, constantly trying to change the plan, constantly rebuffed by Roosevelt. I think he created a degree of uncertainty about how the Vercors might be used, for which I think he's responsible, but I understand what he was trying to do. De Gaulle was wholly different. De Gaulle had a plan. He was desperate to make sure that France would play a part in her own liberation. He did not want to be a subset of either an American invasion in the north or a British invasion in the south. So he had this plan. It was mad by anybody's calculation, but nobody was diplomatically prepared to tell him so, to ignore the major plan from the south going up the Rhone Valley and instead do a French landing into the Massif Central. In the end, that's what the Vercors was sacrificed for. In the end, the resources that could have gone in to save the Vercors at the last minute were held in abeyance to use on de Gaulle's plan. And the Allies' failure to tell him this wasn't going to be acceptable, I think, is also one of the reasons why the Boer Corps was abandoned in the end. But I can't blame de Gaulle. He was trying to do something enormous. He was trying to restore the greatness of France when France could bring nothing to the table. She'd been shamefully defeated. She had no resources to put on the table. She had nothing to bargain with. She had no troops. She wasn't even going to play a big part in her own liberation. De Gaulle's magic in, nevertheless, with nothing in his hand, getting France restored to be a great power after the war was extraordinary. And one of the reasons he got that was because he was prepared to think big, and did.
I was going to ask you, actually, what your take on his character and his personality was.
Oh, dreadful. I think de Gaulle must have been a very unlikable Churchill. Regarded him as a great man, but thought he was very irksome. I thought he was pompous, arrogant, but in many ways, somebody once referred to him as the last great Frenchman, and I agree with that. You would not have wanted to have de Gaulle as a colleague. You would have been bored to death with him about having dinner, because you'd have had no other voice but your own, but his. But as a strategist, as a man, with nothing in his hand, he took on the most powerful man on earth, President Roosevelt, who preferred Giraud, the alternative, who wanted to have an allied military government, and on every front he won, with nothing. That's not bad.
Kind of moving ahead to the events of later that year, you write that the 15th of June was a day of tragedy and loss, while the 16th of June was one of farce and stupidity. for people who might not know, what took place on those 2 days?
15th of June is the first German attempt, successful, after three attempts, to break through the perimeter of the Vercors Plateau and the Battle of Saint-Nizier. It was always the Vercors' most vulnerable point, and I don't think the Vercors commander Huet defended it to the uttermost, and I think he was right not to, because there was a better line of defence further back. So it was the first time the Germans said, look, we're serious about this, guys, we're going to take you out. They came in with heavy artillery and troops. They were robust for the first two attempts, and they drove the match. So that gave them a footing on the plateau itself. It was, I think, an inevitable operation, an inevitable setback for the French. I think they did actually rather well. I think they caused the Germans much more havoc than the Germans expected. And the Germans are quite nervous after that. So, a day of loss of Saint-Nizier, loss of the first to be killed to German troops, loss of a large portion of the northern part of the plateau. But I don't think there's anything shameful about that. The next day, can you imagine it? There is a ludicrous, almost pantomime farce, where the civil head of the Vercors is going down off the plateau to have a meeting, and is stopped by some sentries who belong to one of Jaez, one of the units most opposed to the civilians. He is arrested and taken away to be questioned, at which stage all the civil Maquisards rose up and rush off to arrest the commander. So after this day in which they had to fight the Germans on a united front and did quite well, they then started fighting each other. It was a day of complete farce and stupidity. And it outlines, I think, very clearly the essential internal rift within the Vercors.
Who do you see as being culpable for the events of that day? Do you think it's just one of those long-standing things that came to a head, or is there...
It was undoubtedly a long-standing thing. There was a lot of tension. The military trying to recreate the army of France in the middle of the Vercors. Sam Brown belt, shiny shoes, orderlies looking after the officers, all the regiments with their regimental standards. The scruffy, dirty Maquisards in their Maquisards uniforms who'd been struggling over the mountains and done most of the fighting. There was an inevitable resistance. One, on the other hand, religious and right-wing, the other definitely left-wing and very revolutionary. This was there. There were all sorts of talks about the Allied parachute drops that came in, also dropped in chocolate, but the army got all the chocolate and the Maquisards got none. There was a big struggle about uniforms. They were in tattered clothes. Uniforms were dropped, but the head of the army said he wasn't prepared to have French soldiers wearing foreign uniforms. Completely ridiculous. So there's a lot of internal tension.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you who I blame for it. I mean, I think by and large, Chavon acted with wisdom and was perfectly capable of getting on with reasonable military people. I think Jaez, Narcisse Jaez, a remarkable man in many ways, more out of the 18th century than the 20th, much more at home with with the Four Musketeers as a member of that. But pompous, not very good strategic thinker. I blame him chiefly for this.
Okay, yeah. Moving ahead briefly, well, not briefly, I suppose, but to try and do justice to the events of July 1944. Could you talk through, I suppose, briefly, the German operation and what unfolded during those days?
There were basically three full dress rehearsals for the German operation. There were three previous operations, because the idea of having fortresses, redoubts, réduits in the French phrase, was an idea that had been developed through 1943 and into 1944. The first of them was on the plateau close to Geneva, called the Glière Plateau. And the second of them was in a place called Barcelonnette, just after D-Day. And the third of them was on the Montmorency in the Massif Central. In all of these places after D-Day, the French, Glière before, but in all of these places, the French rose, sought to have a static defence of a fixed fortress type operation. The Germans came in with more troops than people thought they could muster and obliterated them. And their technique for obliterating them was surround, attack, annihilate, destroy. First of all, you take the fortress, you think it's a fortress, you turn it into a prison by putting a cordon around it, then you attack it, then you kill everybody who's there, but who is in the Maquisards, and then you, a scorched earth policy, you destroy everything so it can't be used again. We saw this three dress rehearsals take place, and yet people still continued with the Vercors. I think because they thought the Vercors was too big to be surrounded, that inevitably people could get away. But the German general, Flamme, clearly told in advance of D-Day, for all sorts of understandable reasons, that this was going to be a point of Allied attack, mustered the troops, threw a cordon around it, and then he came in with four columns that were going to take out the Vercors, simultaneously attacking from four different directions, so that the French couldn't respond to a single threat. One came in with armour from the south, over the southern cols. One came in largely with some armour, but from the north, that had already been captured, Saint-Dizier. One came when no one expected them to come, the wonderful Gebirgsjäger of the German Alpine troops, came straight up the steepest mountain over the passes and fought battles on the passes to get through. And then the surprise one came in by gliders. I think originally they were planning parachutists as well, but landed in the middle by gliders. And it was a four-pronged assault to take place simultaneously on the 21st of July.
Do you think there's anything that the fighters could have done to fend off this mass attack? I mean, was there a failure?
No, I think there was a failure, and it's Gers' failure again. I think that the most vulnerable part of this, because the weather suddenly clamped down at midday on the 21st of July, and that means that the first wave of German troops, only 200, got in onto the ground in Vassieux in the centre of the plateau. Then the weather clamped down. They were now very isolated. They couldn't support each other, and they were in four positions, and they were very vulnerable to counterattack. Gier counterattacked them that night. If they'd have got rid of that, I think they'd have had a much better job at protecting the rim. But Gier, tragically, and terrible military error, decided instead of... The Germans had made the mistake of dispersing their forces and couldn't get their reinforcements in. Gier replicated that mistake by dispersing his attack. Instead of concentrating his forces on one, getting rid of that and then dealing with the others, he dispersed his attack, and that meant that each of the positions was able to sustain the attacks that night. The weather was terrible. The Maquisards were untrained, lightly armed. There are all sorts of reasons why they didn't succeed, but the strategic reason, which would have given them a better chance, was because Gier didn't split. He split his forces rather than concentrating.
To what extent can we see the German offensive as being surprising by how kind of massive it was?
It shouldn't have been surprising. You know, we had arguably four dress rehearsals. We had three very clear dress rehearsals. The whole idea, I mean, that somebody thought redoubts would be a good idea is pretty bizarre in my view, because guerrilla warfare, the essence of it is movement, not static defence. However, I can understand why they did. But to have tried it three times and I mean, the reason why they thought they could get away with Radetz was because they didn't think the Germans could muster the forces, because they didn't think the Germans had the will to use it, and because they thought the French maquisards were up to static defensive battles. Yeah. Having on three occasions previously been shown that each of those premises were false, to continue with the Vercors was, in my view, stupidity of a very high order indeed.
The treatment of the people of the Vercors over the next 3 weeks is horrific. Do we get a sense of the attitude of the average German soldiers to this treatment? Do you think there's something they went along with? Were they, I mean...
I think to start with, when the Germans first came in 1941, 42, particularly 42, and 42 and 43, I think France was a cushy number for them. I think this was the land of love. I think that the French were not... the resistance was very small. They were, in comparison to the Eastern Front, living in the lap of luxury. And although the resistance was getting stronger, they weren't hated. By 1944, they'd conducted several operations. They had, the STO had come. They had been guilty of war crimes. They were roundly hated, and the resistance was much, much, much more effective. So I think there was a hardness. There was also, of course, the question that the French themselves had been winning victories and killing Germans. So I think there was a hardness, a sense of revenge, yes, that I think definitely was there. They'd also become inured. There's quite a lot of evidence that the early German troops did not like the kind of atrocities that they were told to commit by the Gestapo, basically. But towards the end, I don't think that was the case. So they went in with a mood of revenge, I think, almost desperation. Mm. What I think separates the horrors, however, is this. It is extraordinary the extent to which each of the commanders, the main German commanders, had actually had the first part of their war on the Eastern Front, had come in from fighting the partisans on the Eastern Front. That's true of two of the column commanders, and it's certainly true of Flamme, the commander himself. It's also true of the head of the Gestapo, Werner Knaap. And I think they quite deliberately imported the tactics that they used on the Eastern Front, and by the way, in Bosnia, in the Yugoslavia, into France. And to add to that, there were what the French called the Mongols, the Eastern troops, the Azerbaijanis, the Uzbeks, who were specialists in sadistic forms of killing. These had been commonly used, perfectly common, not unusual at all on the Eastern Front, but by and large not used in Western Europe. And so I think this is the first occasion in which the techniques, the horrors, the atrocities, which had been established as practice in the Eastern Front, were incorporated and were utilised in Western Europe. And I think sometimes we make an excuse for the Germans with the Eastern troops, because I'm not sure they were responsible for all the horrors. Even if they were, there are very reliable stories of the foul killing being done by the Eastern troops taking place in front of German officers who were their commanders while eating their lunch, those kind of things. So I think what you see here for the very first time in Western Europe is what had been absolutely commonplace on the Eastern Front.
What was the thing that surprised you the most during your research?
I'll tell you what surprised me, because in fact I had several people write to me who know the story well, when I told them what the title of the book was, and I said, I'm going to call it The Victory. And they said, but it wasn't a victory, it was a complete disaster. What surprised me is that what everybody saw as a victory, as a disaster, as a defeat, actually wasn't. It was a victory. It was an extraordinary victory, a victory built on individual courage and leadership. Because when the Maquisards were left to do what they do best, go into the forest, they survived, they came back, they helped to drive the Germans out, and they were preserved, and all the Germans' aims had failed. So what surprised me was that all of France has been talking about this as one of our glorious disasters. Actually, it isn't. Yeah. It's a glorious victory, albeit an extremely cruel one, and one in many ways infected with folly. Yeah. But nevertheless, in the end, the winners in this were not the Germans, they were the French. The young man in the white shirt, in the end, prevailed. That really surprised me and inspired me, I have to say.
That was Paddy Ashdown. The Cruel Victory, The French Resistance, D-Day and the Battle for the Vercors is out now, published by William Collins. Paddy Ashdown will also be talking at this year's History Weekend Festival, to be held in the historic town of Malmesbury from the 16th to the 19th of October. We've still got tickets available for many of the talks, including Paddy's, so please do get your tickets quickly before they sell out. You can find out more details and book at historyweekend.com. And if you'd like to read more from Matt and Paddy, then you can do so in the August issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale this week. It is a First World War special edition, with articles about many different aspects of that conflict, as well as on Tutankhamun, Tudor cleanliness, and plenty more. You can pick up a copy at all good newsagents, and of course as a digital edition. And now we have a short advertisement break.
Kaiser Wilhelm II is one of the most fascinating figures in European history. Ruling Imperial Germany from his accession in 1888 to his enforced abdication at the end of the First World War. In his new book, Wilhelm II, A Concise Life, John Rawl provides an accessible survey of his award-winning three-volume biography of the Kaiser and his reign. The book sheds new light on Wilhelm's troubled youth, his involvement in social and political scandals, and his growing thirst for glory, which provided the impetus for a breathtaking long-term goal: the transformation of the German Reich into one of the foremost powers in the world. The book examines the crucial role played by Wilhelm in the policies that led to war in 1914, and it describes the rabid anti-Semitism he developed in exile, as well as his efforts to regain power. Wilhelm II, A Concise Life, is available to order now, price $16.99.
It's now time for the latest history news with our website editor, Emma McFarnan.
Michael Gove was this week replaced as Education Secretary in Prime Minister David Cameron's wide-ranging cabinet reshuffle. Gove, who had been criticised by some history teachers, was moved to Chief Whip, replaced in his education role by Women's Minister Nicky Morgan. The Historical Association, which supports history teachers and department in both secondary and primary schools, said it looks forward to meeting the new Education Secretary. In a statement, the body said, "It has been an interesting 4 years with Michael Gove in charge of education, and on the positive side, it has been good to have a Secretary of State for Education take a serious interest in history and history in schools. However, not all of Mr. Gove's views have delighted the history community." To read more about this story, visit historyextra.com. In other news, the Imperial War Museum London is due to reopen this weekend following a multi-million pound transformation with new displays to mark the centenary of the First World War. At the new permanent First World War galleries, visitors can learn how the war started and why it continued, and, through the lives of those who experienced it, come to understand the global impact of the conflict. More than 1,300 objects, including weapons, uniforms, diaries, letters and souvenirs, will be on display in the 14 chapters of the galleries. Meanwhile, famous satirical magazine Punch is now available to browse online. The complete run of Punch from 1841 to 1992 has been uploaded to a fully searchable digital archive. Highlights include the comic works of William Thackeray, full-page political cartoons by Winnie the Pooh artist E.H. Shepherd, and Punch's famous parliamentary sketches. Users can search the archive or quickly browse an issue before zooming in or cropping images that can then be saved, printed, or shared via email. The archive also boasts commissioned essays by scholars that provide social and historical context. To find out more about the archive and to view 10 amazing Punch sketches, visit historyextra.com.
Thank you, Emma. During the 1930s, Hastings and St Leonard's on the south coast of England became a mecca for sun worshippers seeking a fashionable but thrifty summer holiday. Our features editor, Charlotte Hodgman, travelled to Hastings to meet the historian Catherine Ferry and find out how the town coped with the influx of tourists as Britain experienced a leisure revolution.
So, Catherine, we've come down to Hastings today to talk about Hastings in the interwar period, kind of a period when people were taking more seaside holidays and things like that. Tell me a little bit about what Hastings looked like during this time.
Well, in the 1920s, it was kind of a town in decline, really, and probably the seafront that we can see from the beach where we're sitting. There were lots of to let signs, for sale signs. It was a bit sort of down on its luck. But then, in 1926, Hastings got a new borough surveyor who really transformed the look of the town. So what we see with the sea wall here and the concrete distinction between land and sea here, that was what happened in the 1930s. The road was brought forwards by quite some degree, a lot of attractions were sort of built into that to make Hastings a much more modern, up-to-date resort. And it was absolutely crucial because seaside business was booming. There was a great market, a great domestic holiday market. So in 1938, you have the Holidays with Pay Act, where legislation is actually allowing people paid leisure time for the first time ever. But even before that, employers had cottoned on to the fact that it was good for their workers to have some annual leave, and so the annual seaside holiday was really becoming the norm for a lot of people. By the end of the decade, by 1939, probably some 15 million people could actually expect to take an annual holiday, and they would expect to take it at the seaside.
And what did they expect from that holiday when they got here? What would they be looking to do and see?
Well, the kind of the things that we would want to do now, I suppose. Mm-hmm. the beach and sunshine. In the 30s particularly, sunshine, just before they knew about skin cancer and everything, sunshine was the new kind of panacea. You think of that 30s period with outdoors. It's the time when outdoors activities are really coming to the fore. It's a new leisure. They actually talk about it as the new leisure of going hiking, being outside in holiday camps, mass health and fitness kind of routines on the beach, people doing sort of early forms of gymnastics and that kind of thing. Really, sunshine is absolutely crucial, and so all these resorts had to update themselves with sunbathing facilities. So you get kind of sunbathing decks on the promenades here. There are sun trap shelters. We've just seen them along by St. Leonard's, and the fantastic Marine Court, great big apartment block, had a sun terrace on its rooftop. So sunshine is absolutely key to what people want, and it's partly sort of inspired by this new aspirational idea of taking the holiday that people know about. They've seen in the movies and the sort of glamour of the south of France, the Riviera.
Yeah.
People, ordinary women wearing the fashion of the time was for beach pyjamas, sort of wide-legged trousers and loose-fitting tops that sort of Parisian socialites might wear at Juan-les-Pins on the Riviera, but they would come to Hastings and wear them and feel as if they were glamorous for that short seaside break. And so even though our British summertime doesn't sort of guarantee sunshine, any sunshine that they had to be absolutely capitalised upon.
Okay. And you mentioned the borough architect, Sidney Little, that we were talking about earlier. So were the changes that he made to Hastings, were they designed to get more people here?
Oh, totally, yeah. I mean, if you think 15 million people can now take a holiday, and they could go anywhere, because the whole point about this period as well, there's increasing affluence allowing people to go on holiday, but they lots of them have now got cars.
Yeah.
And that's a huge sea change, because it's not just a question of going to your local resort. Once you've got a car, you can go wherever you want, and you don't have to stay if you don't like it. So from the resort's point of view, that's a real game changer, because they actually have to make sure that what they offer is better than the place down the road.
Yeah.
So what Sidney Little does here is hugely transformative, and it's really about bringing the resort up to date. Just down the road, you've got Bexhill, where they've, in 1935, they opened the Delaware Pavilion. Brighton's got all its amenities and is updating with something like the iconic Embassy Court in a very modernist style. And what Sydney Little does here is transforms the entire promenade into this kind of sun worshipper's dream.
Mm.
And then he adds a Lido as well, which is, you know, all resorts with any pretensions, they must have a Lido. It's the phenomenal. You'd think that you've got this amazing resource of the sea here right next to us, so why would you build a Lido? But between 1930 and 1939, 180 Lidos were built up and down the country, lots of them at seaside places. And you had to have one because it wasn't just about swimming. It was about the sunbathing. It was seeing and being seen.
So it's a status thing as much as
completely,
anything.
Completely, yeah, and completely. And crucial that you spend quite a lot of money on them because in the PR terms of the time, the money is definitely a factor in the guidebooks, etc. It tells you exactly how much is spent on all these things. So, for example, Blackpool's open-air baths opened in 1923. They spent £80,000 on it. You think of the size of Blackpool as a resort and the number of people that are going there. Well, Hastings, in 1931, they spent £60,000 on their Lido. And they've only ever been a kind of medium-sized resort, but they really are trying very hard to raise their profile and really attract a different type of visitor.
And there's still a phenomenal amount of architecture that Sydney Little did actually design. It's still here today. Most of it concrete.
Yes.
why concrete?
Well, concrete was the material of the age, really. Mm. And it's all part of the modernist aesthetic coming in from Europe, and you can get very clean lines to it. And it's, I suppose, it's the break with tradition, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's everything that the previous generation was not. If you think of the Victorians with their red brick, and before that Georgian stucco, and then you have 1930s concrete, and that is completely the material of the era. Concrete and sunshine, you know, that sort of encapsulates it.
And we were saying earlier that it does have a more of a 60s feel to it. So you were saying that, you know, it was quite ahead of its time, some of the things that he designed.
I think so, yeah. I mean, the Lido had, it was just kind of concrete block, no ornamentation, almost sort of brutalist in the way it was dealt with. Very, very, very much embracing the concrete as a material, what it can do, in a way that people would go on to do after the Second World War. And you see that he was a very clever man, Sydney Little. The car parks that he designed underground here, which were, in fact, the first in the world built under civic auspices, they have this sort of amazing cinematic quality because there's these it's all concrete again, obviously, the concrete arches as they recede into the distance, and you're standing in this, it's a car park, and yet you look, it's kind of like being in an Isha print, or, you know, that kind of 1930s cinema element of it. There's something he did something really quite clever with concrete here, and as you say, you can come and see it.
Even the
car park, you know.
Well, I accidentally parked in the car park, and
it's very functional, all of this. That's the whole point, you know, the double-decker promenade where we've been. It works because if the rain comes, you can go on the lower promenade and you're sheltered from the rain, and if it's a sunny day, you've got the wonderful upper promenade you can walk along, and it connects Hastings and St Leonard's as it has done for 80 odd years. So.
And how were his designs received by the people of Hastings and just generally?
Well, I think Hastings knew that they needed to do something quite dramatic to update their town, and actually the people of Hastings were campaigning for a Lido before one was built, so I think they had a sense, the people, that this needed to be done. I'm not really sure quite how they reacted to the concrete. One guidebook of the late 20s talked about the White Rock Pavilion here, which was opened in 1927 as a sort of entertainment venue, and that's in a kind of slightly Italian style with pavilions. It's very much of the 1920s. It's an attractive building, but it's not the Delaware Pavilion. It's not eye-catching. It's not modernist. And yet this guidebook talked about it as being ultra-modern and demonstrating the courage of the borough. And then you see what Sydney Little did with concrete. I mean, that was ultra-modern.
Yeah.
And it really must have been, if you think what what came beforehand. We've had the 60s in between, so we know about concrete, what it can do, you know, in all its forms. But coming from the 20s and the Victorian past, it must have been such a huge change for people to see all this happening on their their seafront. And that was part of the appeal, I suppose, for the holidaymakers, because it was actually saying this is an up-to-date resort. This is something really different that you can't get anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, what was Sidney Little's background?
He was born in 1885 in Carlisle and came from an engineering family background, and he. Before coming to Hastings in 1926, he's worked as a deputy borough engineer in Ipswich. And Hastings was his kind of dream job, really, because they just gave him free rein to do all these projects because the town was in such a state. The roads were terrible, the sanitation was awful. You know, it got to the point where they had to invest. And, you know, they spent some £3 million on transforming the town, and that's in 30s money.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that was really huge sums of money.
And did he go on to do other things after Hastings, other places?
I believe during the war he was involved with the Mulberry Harbours, I guess for the concrete.
Yeah.
Mean, all that experience he had of concrete. But this is his finest achievement, the 30s period in Hastings and St Leonard.
And I suppose this was kind of interrupted by another war. Did things change after that at all, in terms of people taking holidays and things like that?
Yeah, I think expectations that you would go to the seaside as your holiday, that certainly changed. Although, certainly in terms of visitor numbers, the immediate post-war period is when you get the real heyday, because people can't afford to go anywhere else. But then things start to change. In the 30s, a lot of towns and resorts have huge capital sums to invest. After the Second World War, they simply don't.
No.
So the kind of money that Sidney Little could play with here during the interwar period, that had all dried up. Yeah. And so seaside resorts were sort of trading on their past glories a bit. And that didn't matter in the early 50s when people didn't have much option. But when in the 60s people could start to afford to go abroad, the architecture and the facilities from the pre-war period beginning to look a bit shabby and a bit tired, and resorts didn't have the money to really upgrade in the way that they might have done. People were going in search of more reliable sunshine and going on package deals. So, yeah, after the war it did change.
So was travelling abroad not really an option during this period? Did people do that?
People did. Wealthy people did.
Yeah.
Absolutely, they did. And that was part of the appeal of that whole idea of, you know, pretending you're in the French Riviera, or go to Torquay and go to the British Riviera, because people with money, fashionable people, could afford to go abroad, and you just had to come to Hastings and pretend that you were abroad. But it was a much more limited section of the population that could afford to do so in that time. But somewhere like Marine Court, where we've been looking at, and there are other examples of buildings that mirror the sort of ocean liner aesthetic. Marine Court here is this whopping great apartment building. It's 14 stories high. When it was built, it was the largest residential development in the country.
Wow.
It was talked about as a skyscraper. Obviously it's not. It was the same period that the Empire State Building was going up, so it's a completely different thing, really. But at the time, it was something very novel and different, and its design was based on the Queen Mary ocean liner, which launched in 1936. Marine Court in St Leonard's opened in 1937.
Okay.
So it's absolutely saying you can come for a cruise on land, come and stay in this building. And there were a lot of instances of this. Cruising was deeply fashionable,
right,
deeply expensive. So how do you get around that? Well, you offer ordinary people this sort of vision of what it might be like to be on a cruise ship. Holiday camps did it. You could go and play deck games. You play quoits at the holiday camp in a building that was designed to look a bit like an ocean liner. Some of them had funnels on and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The casino, the entrance building to Blackpool Pleasure Beach, is one very modernist example of that kind of ocean liner aesthetic as well.
And Marine Court, you know, in its profile, does look like a ship, doesn't it?
It does. It completely. It's locally nicknamed the ship.
Yeah.
And it was at the time described as the liner on land. And actually, in 1937, as part of the Hastings Carnival, Q Cunard White Star Line lent the developers a 24-foot-long model of the Queen Mary to actually display in Marine Court, so you could kind of look at the similarities. And you know, if you hadn't worked it out already, you could see how very similar these things were.
Oh, okay. And would people sort of do? Would they sort of stay in this area? Would it, was it all about being in Hastings and by the sea? Would they travel and do other things?
Thanks to the growth of car ownership, people could travel and do more things in a way that they wouldn't have been able to before. And that's why we're focusing on one of the car parks here as well, because cars, seaside traffic jams were already becoming a real problem. You think of them as kind of a modern era thing, and that's not true at all. It was in the 1930s that traffic jams to the seaside first came about, and the figures are astonishing. In 1914, there are 140,000 vehicles on the road. By 1939, there's 3 million.
Gosh, that's huge.
That's huge. And 2 million of those are private cars. And you think, on a summer weekend, those cars are heading to the seaside. Yeah. It's not just about the traffic jams to get there. What do you do with them all when you arrive? You know, you're talking about essentially Victorian resorts with roads that were made for horses and carriages, not cars. And so Sidney Little built in Hastings and St Leonard's three underground car parks that could accommodate eventually 1,200 vehicles. And that was a, you know, that made the national press. That was a major thing, because the motor car in the interwar years was certainly a status symbol, but something that, you know, you could not avoid. It must have been astonishing, that rapid change of, you know, if you're a person growing up in that period, you know, you, before the First World War, you see these vehicles intermittently, and then come the Second World War, they're just everywhere. It must have been quite an astonishing thing to be part of, really.
And are there other sort of seaside resorts in Britain that had the same sort of level of change that Hastings went through during this period?
There are landmark buildings at lots of other resorts that you can pick out, and you can say somewhere like the Midland Hotel in Morecambe, for example, is a modernist icon. The Delaware Pavilion at Bexhill is the same. Funnily enough, if there had been the finances, Bexhill would have been completely transformed beyond the pavilion. There were plans to have an entertainment centre, blocks of flats along the promenade, you know, get rid of all the Edwardian stuff and turn it into this modern centre. The drawings exist, I think, still. But they never did it. At Hastings, they put their money where their mouth was, and the whole promenade was transformed.
Yeah.
So I think it is unique in that, actually.
Yeah. I mean, and I couldn't believe how much there is still to see. I mean, almost everywhere you walk and look, you know, from bus shelters to you know, to little sort of nooks and crannies and little sort of benches built into concrete and things like that. It's, you know, it's everywhere you look. There's sort of evidence of this period, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's elegantly done as well. I mean, you talk about the concrete, and people might think, well, that doesn't sound terribly enticing, but it's done with great panache here. I think Sidney Little was a very clever man.
And the bottle alley that we looked at earlier,
that's fantastic. Yeah, there's a double decker promenade, and we were saying that you could shelter on the lower deck, and the rear wall of that is studded with bottle glass. And apparently Sidney Little came across all these old unwanted bottles at the rubbish tip and salvaged them all. It's sort of 1930s upcycling, you know. They're set into plaster on this back wall, and they just transform it from being a walkway into something
quite special.
Absolutely, yeah.
And where would people have stayed when they... You mentioned holiday camps and things like that. Were they sited by the seaside?
Holiday camps tended to be sited by the seaside, yeah, for the reason that, you know, the seaside is where you go on holiday. That's been a traditional thing to do. But somewhere like Hastings, you'd probably still expect to stay in a sort of boarding house, that kind of relatively old-fashioned arrangement. B&Bs didn't really come in till after the Second World War, and boarding houses were quite a tricky thing to negotiate. They had bad reputation of the landlady who locked you out after breakfast and let you in for your meal times, and then, you know, if it's raining, it doesn't matter, you don't have a key, you're chucked out. And so that's why kind of having these sort of shelters on the promenade and places to relax and sit down, that's important if you don't have a base, you know, like we expect to do now, come and go as you please. That just wasn't the norm, that wasn't how you did it. But the problem in the interwar period for hoteliers and landladies was that because of the motor car, people didn't have to stay here. They could go elsewhere. And so there was there's the beginning of the transformation of the sort of hospitality industry, really, that towards shorter stays, I suppose.
Yeah. And would people come down for sort of weekend trips, or would people have like the one summer holiday every year?
Yeah, they didn't have lots of holidays like we could expect to now. But I think if there were sunny weekends, people would be leaving the city and
follow the sun.
Absolutely, yeah. And in the past, that would have been on a train, going on a cheap excursion, maybe. And in the 30s, of course, it's not just motor cars, it's motor coaches as well, allowed more people the opportunity to go to the seaside and to places that they couldn't have done before. If you're relying on a railway, you have to go where the train takes you.
Yeah.
But a coach or a car, you can go any manner of places. So the seaside tourism industry is really, really expanding, and resorts have to invest in order to get those important visitors and to try and keep them, you know, once they're here.
Yeah.
To stop them turning around and going down the road to the next place.
Yeah.
That was Catherine Ferry. You can read her feature on the British holiday boom in the August issue of BBC History magazine, which, as I mentioned earlier, is out now. And Catherine's forthcoming book, Bungalows, will be published in August by Shire Books. Okay, that is almost all for this week. Do please get in touch with your thoughts about this podcast on podcast@historyextra.com, and we will do our best to read out some of your messages in the future. One listener who contacted us recently was Luke McCallin. Luke says, "I've been meaning to write for you for a long time to express my appreciation and enjoyment of your podcast, which is a weekly treat on my commute. I'm constantly surprised by the things I learn, most recently about English gardens, and there's rarely a dull moment to be had. Having prevaricated endlessly on writing to you, it was your recent podcasts on Gavrilo Princip and by Adam Tooze on the legacy of the First World War, which really convinced me that now was the time. I myself lived and worked in Bosnia for many years, and I found Mr. Butcher's remarks about that country and about Mr. Princip to be very interesting, as well as Mr. Tooze's analysis of the 1930s, and in particular his vignettes about the major personalities of the Versailles Conference were insightful and trenchant." Thank you for that, Luke. And if you've missed either of those episodes, then they are still available to download from our website and numerous podcast services. The Adam Tooze interview was broadcast on the 12th of June, and Tim Butcher's discussion of Gavrilo Princip appeared on the 22nd of May, both this year. Please do keep your thoughts coming in on email and also social media. On Twitter we are @HistoryExtra, and on Facebook we're also History Extra. And do make sure to check out our website, historyextra.com, for the latest history news, quizzes, galleries, articles and hundreds of episodes of this podcast, which go back to 2007. Next week we'll be discussing Richard III with Chris Skidmore, while Pamela Hartshorne will be investigating Tudor filth. Do join us for that. This History Extra podcast was recorded on location in Hastings and in Somerset, and produced by Jack Fletcher.